If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
Matt Devoti has made a splash in his first 8 months on the St. Louis Board of Aldermen. He has maneuvered legislation that codifies the duties of the sheriff's office into law and set up limits on the use of golf carts on city streets. And Devoti, an attorney, isn't done. He wants to set up a clearer process for handling nuisance properties and behaviors, and he's expected to be involved in rewriting the city's contracting processes. He says that's the biggest impediment to getting aid to tornado survivors. The alderman of the 5th Ward joins me next on the latest episode of Politically Speaking. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
We've seen a county government that has had smooth and steady leadership, and I think we're on a good path right now.
I realize the office needed a prosecutor to run it.
And we have a better solution of addressing those needs.
I don't think it's about a popularity contest. What I think it about is it's time for change.
Working together across city and county, across political affiliations, that we can start to find overlapping goals.
I had some moments where I had to, you know, lean into my courage.
You'll see us work together on areas of agreement, and you'll see us have difficult conversations when we don't agree.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, Rachel Lippman. Joining me in the studio today is
Matt Devoti.
He is the alderman of the 5th Ward. And alderman, for those of us who don't stare at the ward maps as often as we do, remind listeners where the 5th Ward is within the city.
Sure. The 5th Ward takes up a fair amount of South St. Louis. It runs from the hill south directly to Southampton. We're essentially hemmed in by Hampton on the west, Kings Highway on the east, Manchester, and Eichelberger, with one exception. We include the Botanical Garden.
And this is your first time on the podcast because you are a relatively newly elected alderperson of about 8 months. So this is your chance to introduce yourself to people who may not know who Matt Devoti is.
Yeah, sure. And I appreciate the opportunity, Rachel. I am, first and foremost, a city resident. Lived in the city for about 25 years. Married. I have 5 kids. They range in age from 5 all the way up to 25. I'm a lawyer. I'm a trial lawyer by trade, and I've represented folks, individuals, my entire practice. And of course, as you mentioned, I'm the relatively new 5th Ward Alderman.
And you had been involved in politics in the background for a while. You were the treasurer of other aldermanic candidates. Why was 2025 the time to step into the foreground as a candidate?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm a longtime resident of the Hill. We were very fortunate to have an alder in place for a fairly long period of time, Joe Vollmer.
33 years, I believe, something like that?
I was going to say 22.
You might be right about that, yeah.
But in any event, Joe was there. Joe did a wonderful, solid job for the ward, for the neighborhood. And word got out that Joe was stepping away. I have been involved, as you mentioned, in the background, and also been involved in the Hill neighborhood for many, many years. And I thought this would be a natural progression of what I've done into stepping out in front and trying to help folks, frankly.
Now, the nature of what was the 10th Ward had changed a little bit with the expansion into the now 5th Ward. But were you surprised that you didn't face any opposition in that first race?
I was very surprised, especially with how long the seat had been held. I thought that there would be a number of candidates, folks that stepped up. So I was shocked when the filing date came and passed and nobody filed.
Do you think there's any one specific reason for that or just a confluence of events?
Well, I would like to think a couple of things. First, I've been involved in the neighborhood and not just in the neighborhood, but South St. Louis for many, many years. I would like to think that once word got out that I was going to run, even before filing, that folks recognized that I was a solid dude who would do the work and represent the neighborhood, the neighborhoods very well. So that's my, glass half full way of looking at it.
What was the biggest assumption that you had about how the city works that was disproven in either a good way or a bad way as you dove into the aldermanic role?
Well, let me talk about what I've been impressed with over the last 8 to 9 months, and that is the dedication of city employees. What I didn't know as a resident was how severely understaffed we are. Now, what does that mean? That means the people that are working, that are driving the trash trucks, working on the street crews, that are working at City Hall, are busting tail end, not just to do their job, but most probably a quarter, a third, a half job of somebody else. I've been very, very impressed.
What was, as you were, I'm assuming, probably on the budget committee hearings, the one story or the one thing that was emblematic of where you sat there and went, this is the key example of how short-staffed the city of St. Louis is?
I can remember it was about day two, maybe day three of the budget hearing, and I heard for the second, third, fourth time the phrase salary savings. Listen, I'm a lawyer. I run a small business, a small firm. In my small firm, I never heard the phrase salary savings. What I learned is that meant that there is money that is set aside to pay someone who has a particular position. And we actually have budgeted into the city budget the notion that we have a position on the books that isn't filled, that probably won't be filled. And because of that, the city's going to experience a savings, a salary savings. That shocked me. You know, we talk in terms of rate of pay, and my gut reaction was, why are we not increasing pay to fill these positions? And maybe not all of them, but to be competitive and hold on to people, because we are losing really good people to our competition.
And I'm guessing that salary savings is they just sort of build in this idea that, oh, we're going to spend under budget to make it look better, when the reality is, you know, like you said, they're never going to fill those positions. We'll spend the money elsewhere kind of thing.
I'm not that cynical. I would like to think that the salary savings is there because at one point in time, the city was running on all cylinders. At one point in time, we were stacking, we were filling those positions. And for whatever reason, we haven't done it. Maybe last year, 5 years, 10 years, whatever it might be.
The city has done a pay study that has made some recommendations. Do you agree with those recommendations, or what more would you want to add to that?
Oh, absolutely. Getting that data, comparing how we pay folks to how like positions are paid in St. Louis County or West County municipalities, oh my gosh, Rachel. I mean, absolutely necessary. Very, very welcomed. Now, I think the key is we have heard promises from the administration about making those raises, putting some of those recommendations into place. It's got to happen. It's got to happen, not just with our current employees, but with open positions so that we can fill them.
Do you think the city has, from your understanding of the city's budget, the fiscal wherewithal to get paid where it needs to be and then to sustain that?
I think where we are today is that we can hit either at or very close to the midpoint of salaries for like government positions. And here's what I mean by that. We aren't, for a refuse driver, we're not necessarily going to compete with Midwest Waste. But what we can do is we can compete with the municipality that is hiring refuse drivers. We can meet them and we can beat them. And with our benefit plan, we can keep people on the payroll. Our employees, and this is something that I don't know that I realize, but many of our folks have been beat down publicly on the radio, in the paper, on TV for so long that the approach, it's down. And I think one of the things that we need to do is work on that job well done, the shows of appreciation. I do think that makes a difference.
You mentioned that you learned, you know, how understaffed the city is. What have been some of the other key things, maybe that aren't big policy things, but just the nuts and bolts of city government that maybe you thought you knew and realized that you don't actually know in these 8 months?
So one of the things that that fascinated me when I first came into office was how the city addresses service complaints or service requests. As a resident, I would go onto the online site, the Citizen Service Bureau is what it's called, or I would make that 1-800 phone call, and I would plug in information and, you know, how does this happen? You know, it may not happen at the speed I wanted, but at some point, maybe the pothole gets repaired, maybe it doesn't. What I learned is that there is a protocol in place, and when the protocol is followed, the service gets done very efficiently, very effectively. I think this goes to resident education, which we have spent a tremendous amount of time in 8-9 months. Make sure you let the city know what's your address or what is the address of the issue. Be specific as to what the problem is. If possible, take a photograph. I know that sounds really basic, but when folks don't provide the basics, and many people don't, the city or the person whose desk it hits has nothing to go on. And then a level of frustration hits. That education, already in 8 to 9 months, we are seeing a tremendous turnaround in attitude, both in terms of the folks we're dealing with at City Hall, but also our residents in the neighborhoods.
When residents do follow that protocol, but the system doesn't work for them, have you figured out where the disconnect is? Like, what is slowing down those properly made requests?
And sometimes it's a matter of simple human error. Somebody hits somebody's email, it hits their desk, and it simply gets overlooked. Or perhaps it is routed to a particular department incorrectly by CSB when it needs to be in somebody else's hands. And the matter is administratively closed, or it really should be transferred to another department. That's one of those things that we still need to iron out the problem. We have too many requests that are administratively closed that really need to go somewhere else versus just being marked done.
And I know you mentioned that you try not to be as cynical about things. Is this, as far as I know, like the online collection of this has been happening for a little bit. Shouldn't it have been ironed out by now? Like, what's going on?
Without a doubt. No excuse. I can remember making a CSB request probably 15 to 20 years ago that was never acted on. And I didn't follow up. And I think we have given as residents, the bar is too low. And as a resident, what I tell the folks in the Fifth Ward is, hold us accountable. If you've got an issue, don't keep hitting your head against the wall. For certain, don't just walk away and say, well, I live in the city, too bad. No, hold us accountable. Send me an email. Make a phone call. Catch me on the street. We will get it taken care of. But I think through that getting it taken care of, we are working with the heads, the commissioners, and the directors of the departments to say, this is where we're falling down on the job. If people just get frustrated and don't follow up, end of story, right? So the city, we've got to learn what our mistakes are. We need resident help. We need people to be banging on the drum.
This is a philosophical debate that I've kind of seen start to bubble up at the board sometimes, which is the balancing legislation versus the constituent services. Does this all tilt it maybe more heavily towards constituent services when people are paying taxpayer money to have these services work in the first place? They shouldn't have to call an alderman and be like, that dumpy car is still sitting out here 2 months later and I've followed up and followed up and followed up and laws instead.
Agreed. They shouldn't have to do that, but they do. And let's remember, though, this isn't a City of St. Louis problem. It might be more of a degree in the city. We might have work to do in the city. But I've got relatives that live in Wildwood, that live in Valley Park, that live in Chesterfield and Manchester. Our issues are not unique to the city. We're much more vocal about it. The media covers our issues in the city, but they happen everywhere.
What was that CSB request that never got fulfilled? Do you remember?
It had to do with signage, I believe.
Okay.
It had to do with a no parking sign on the curb very near my house that was driving me crazy.
You have had some blockbuster pieces of legislation in your first term. The first one was legislation that sets the duties of the sheriff's office into city law. What was your motivation behind wanting that codified somewhere?
My motivation was a public official, in this case, the sheriff, not taking responsibility, not owning a part of the job he clearly wasn't doing. And it drove me crazy. To be clear, the ordinance didn't create or didn't put any new duties on the sheriff. But to the extent that the sheriff didn't admit what his duties were, we passed legislation. The idea being, this isn't going to happen again. The big one was the transport of detainees from the CJC for medical transport. And we can't be arguing over something like that. Otherwise, it's going to end up, and it will end up, in the hands of someone who has a practice, a law practice like me, when the worst case scenario happens. And there is no excuse for that.
Why was it the purview of the St. Louis Board of Aldermen to dictate the duties as opposed to some other entity, be it the courts, be it the state, be it, you know, take your pick?
Well, great question, right? It was our purview because we are the legislative body of the city of St. Louis. The CJC is something that comes within our purview. And the sheriff, though a county office, has certain municipal responsibilities. So it fell to the board as the legislative body to take bull by horns and get the job done, to clarify the duties, to make sure we weren't arguing about it in the past. I think that brings up another really good question, which is, should the sheriff of the city of St. Louis be an elected position?
Quite literally on my list, so go ahead.
No, and my thought is absolutely not. Our sheriff is unlike the other 120-plus sheriffs throughout the state of
Missouri.
I think
it's more similar to St. Louis County in terms of its duties and that there's no law enforcement provision in there.
Absolutely. Every one of those enumerated duties is attached to the courts, whether it is transporting detainees, to providing security to our judges, to whatever it might be. Serving papers. Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Man, I can't believe, as a lawyer, how did I lose that one? So my thought is, and with all due respect to city voters, we have a position whose entire duties revolve around that circuit courthouse. His employer or his supervisor should be the circuit judges, should be the 22nd Judicial Circuit. If I could wave a magic wand, tomorrow, the circuit would be making the appointment and supervising the St. Louis City Sheriff.
Are you in conversations with any state representatives who would have the ability to make that change to the office?
We have been, yes. I have been in touch with Southside representatives who are looking at the issue. My understanding is that they are working on legislation and preparing to file it.
Now, will it go anywhere this year? Who knows? But
you've got to take a first step. It's got to be filed.
You have been in and around St. Louis courthouses for a while, as you mentioned. I'm wondering what you make about the current fracas and brouhaha and drama surrounding the sheriff's office.
Frustrating, annoying. It is something, frankly, that we should have never gotten to this point.
And what does this kind of drama mean for just the general operation of the courts and the duties of the sheriff's office?
Well, our problem right now, Rachel, is that we have a sheriff who is sitting in federal lockup in a county outside of the state of Missouri. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that someone in federal custody can't do their job. That's without dispute. So because of that, we have an interim sheriff. Or at least in a
temporary interim, whatever
I was
going to
say.
You
know, as soon as I said interim, I know that wasn't necessarily the title or the description put on the position by the circuit court, but we have this person who is temporarily manning the position, which then leads to more discussion, which I know you're aware of, between the board, the mayor and the governor about who appoints that interim position. There is so much drama, so much chaos and hand-wringing over a position that if it was merely appointed by the circuit judge, you and I would never be talking about it.
This question is based on the assumption that the sheriff leaves office, whether he's ousted by the quo or he is prosecuted and found guilty or whether he just resigns. What is your interpretation of state law as to who fills that truly interim position until the next election? Who chooses that?
Sure. My interpretation is that the county commission makes the decision on the interim appointment. And again, let's be very clear. We're talking about an interim appointment.
Until the next, so that would be 26 then? Are we looking at that? Or is it the next time the office would be up?
It would be not until the next time the office is up, but there would be an election to then, to elect, as under current law, the replacement. Under my interpretation, again, that would be the county commission. There is no doubt in my mind that is not the governor. No doubt in my mind that the state of Missouri has no part in choosing that interim position. I think then looking at case law, and again, as a lawyer, we love looking at cases. We love looking at precedent. The legal—
Only the ones that prove your point, though.
Well, that's right. That's our job as an advocate, right? In this case, the cases that prove our point are ones that identify the Board of Aldermen as that body. So that would be my position. I can see a statutory argument on a three-headed monster involving the board, the mayor, and the comptroller would be an alternative way to go about it. But again, looking at case law, I'm going to put my hands on that precedent every day of the week.
Your second big piece of legislation was placing regulations on golf carts on city streets. I'm assuming I can take a guess on what the motivation is there, but I do want to hear it from you.
It goes back to my practice of representing folks who have been injured, including folks who have been on golf carts and been injured while on streets. It also goes back to the point that for the last 10 years or so, I have lived in the Hill neighborhood, which probably has as many golf carts around as any place but Benton Park, but Soulard.
I feel like Soulard was the OG and it sort of spread from there.
I'm not going to argue with that. I'm not going to get into that decision. But I would say that there are as many golf carts in just about any neighborhood in the city but for the two others I mentioned.
What are some of the new rules or limitations or regulations that are now on golf carts in the city?
Very basic. I mean, think in terms of common sense. You've got to have a driver's license. You've got to follow rules of the road, meaning stopping at stop signs, stopping at electrical signals.
To the extent that anyone does that in the city of St. Louis.
We're not going to argue about that. But like any motorist, you've got the responsibility to follow rules of the road. If you have a passenger who's a child, that child needs to be in a safety restraint system similar to what you'd have in your motor vehicle, your SUV, your car. You've got to have headlights, side mirrors, and with respect to where you can operate them, you cannot drive on sidewalks. You cannot drive in city parks unless authorized by the commissioner of parks. And you can drive on any street with a mile per hour of 25 or less, and 30 miles per hour if it's three lanes or less.
What do you say to the people who are like, it's great that we have these regulations, but it's just going to be another traffic regulation that isn't enforced in the city?
That kind of cynicism is what gets us in trouble in the city of St. Louis. That kind of cynicism drives me crazy. Again, let's go back to how we started this conversation. We must hold each other accountable, whether it's your alder, whether it's the street department, whether it's the police department. We must hold our city officials accountable. In my discussions with 2nd District officers, the 5th Ward is entirely in the 2nd District, we have had very good conversations about expectations, not just of me, but of residents, with respect to traffic control. our officers in the 2nd District have been responsive. Do we need more on the street? We do. We do. I'm not going to argue about that. But I do believe that our officers, when they see a violation, are stopping people and they're writing citations. I have no doubt about that.
They haven't been in effect for too long, but if you started to see an impact of the regulations in the Hill in terms of feeling safer with them out there.
I will say that at least with respect to parking on sidewalks, no. With respect to stopping at intersections, yes. And I haven't seen, since the mayor signed the bill, a kid driving a golf cart in the Hill neighborhood. And that was a major problem. Now, I will say that when mayor signed the bill, we were already into mid, late-ish October.
Not the best weather for golf carts in the city of St. Louis.
Yes. Let's see how things go in the spring.
What else is on your legislative agenda for the rest of your first term?
Yeah. You know, a couple of things. One of the things we are researching and we're focusing now has to do with problem properties. These are, I think the bane of just about every alder's existence. A problem property has different degrees depending on what neighborhood you're living in. But no matter the neighborhood, they make it very difficult to establish stable blocks. We've got to address them. What we have in the city right now is a series of nuisance ordinances that outlaw certain activity, but they also direct various departments to take bull by horns and deal with it. Which, when we talk about the CSB system that we also spoke about earlier, can become very confusing, even for the folks at CSB. Again, this goes back to misassignment of issues and service requests and dealing with those properties in an efficient way. So what we're looking at right now, we have identified all of our nuisance ordinances. We are taking a look at how the individual departments handle assignments given them. And the idea is to create a system where there is a central, the responsibility is on a department to field all inquiries and then farm them out as necessary so that we've got a specific framework in place to deal with issues. In other words, if the ball gets dropped, we know exactly where to check, which is a problem today.
And this is specific to nuisance property. So how is it, almost like a funnel in, funnel out kind of situation? Like complaints come into CSB, they determine it's nuisance properties, it goes to this point and then goes back out? Or what's the flow chart here?
Let me be very clear. We are talking generally about nuisances. So I'm talking about, on one hand, issues with properties, broken windows, open doors, gutters falling down, buildings lacking a wall, you know, at their very, very worst. I'm also talking about nuisance activities. So in some instances, the known drug house in the neighborhood, that place where folks have no regard for their neighbors and they're out at all hours of the night and you've got people coming and going. So to be clear, the way I'm looking at the legislation is to deal with both property as well as people nuisances. Now, how does it look? My idea would be is that they come in and they are funneled in to a central point at which then, depending on the kind of issue, they are then distributed to the department who is in the best position to address it.
So there'd be specific, like you said, ordinances. If somebody makes a complaint that seems to fit in with one of those ordinances, it goes to a point, and that point person then, you're programming it a little bit differently and putting the assignment into one place, centralizing that.
Absolutely. And the whole thing goes back to accountability. The idea that we have a framework in place that everybody is aware of, that everybody knows, and we could literally follow from step to step to step what is supposed to happen. And when the ball gets dropped, we can trace it back and figure out exactly why it's getting dropped. Your next question might be, well, Matt, why is that important? It's important so that we can see from a system approach. Where is our system falling down? If we know where we're having a system problem, we can address it and we can take care of it.
What's your speculation based on some of the research that you have done where the system problem is right now?
The finger point. The idea that CSB assigns a particular issue to a department which doesn't oversee that issue, and it gets administratively closed out. And that's the end of it. In 30 days, 60 days later, resident is wondering, what happened to my service request? What happened to my nuisance complaint? And then if they look and they search, and they've got to do that, right? They find out that it's administratively been closed, which leads to a lot of frustration.
I know that you and some of the other attorneys at your firm went up into the tornado zone in the immediate aftermath to help individuals handle some of the legal matters that pop up after natural disasters. Have you been able to be back since?
I haven't. Once we got past the initial, I don't know, let's say 30 days of the crisis, Legal Services, who has a long history of dealing with these kinds of things, then took over. We were able essentially to provide triage. We received direction from Legal Services. We coordinated with folks in our network, including the Missouri Association of Trial Lawyers. And at that point, once the triage was administered, Legal Services was in a position to use its framework and its lawyers to help folks. And they have done a wonderful job.
From the time that you've spent up there, and I know you mentioned it was at the beginning, but what do you see as still being the biggest need in the impacted areas that the city can meet?
Housing, specifically interim housing. In my opinion, the city of St. Louis is never going to be in the financial position to help rebuild or to build. That's my belief. I don't see how the funds happen. What we can do and what we must do is we've got to help folks find shelter that is within our capacity. And we have folks in North City within that zone that desperately, desperately need shelter and basic day-to-day needs. We have to do it. We must do that.
And so what is that looking like to you?
So, I mean, that's a great question, that I have talked with, and I've heard Julian Nix in the mayor's office talk a tremendous amount about. I think it's anything from temporary housing at an outfit like Peter and Paul in North City, something like that where we have rooms, small apartments, that are at the disposal of professionals that have been doing this kind of work for years and years and years. I think the other thing we have to do then is maybe find alternatives that you know, how some of us talk in terms of maybe shelters that aren't for a specific family or a person, but can accommodate more than a handful of folks. What does that look like? I've heard Mr. Nix talk about everything from a handful of folks of the same gender to, a room that at least during the evening, the overnight hours, might be able to house 100 people, if not more. I know, I realize, because I've heard lots of residents say, that's not ideal. That's not what I want. I think our problem here is from a very practical standpoint of finding a roof is that we simply don't have enough roofs at our disposal to meet all of those needs. So we've got to look at what maybe our second or our third best possibility. And I think that's going to probably be it, at least for this first winter.
Is the city moving fast enough to get the relief that it is outlined out to people?
No.
What's going on there?
It's not. I think it goes back generally to how the city of St. Louis is set up, management-wise and administratively. I know people don't want to hear about it, but we also know that our mayoral race and our comptroller race were in many parts about updating city structures, updating the way we handle contracts, we handle needs, we get money identified and pushed out the door. That historic system is tying our hands. I have heard Mr. Nix talk in terms of the frustration of needing to obtain a certain number of bids to satisfy city policy. Once those bids are in hand, running them through E&A, running them through the committee that deals with expenditures, needing to have a hearing, needing to have contracts signed with wet signatures by multiple people.
And wet signatures, for those who aren't familiar, is you mean you can't use DocuSign. You've got to actually physically scribble your signature.
I'm talking, Rachel, yes. You've got to find somebody, stick a contract under their nose. It's archaic in 2025. But that's the system that was in place. And that's holding us up. We're getting there. But that held us up.
Are you talking about changing the overall structure with a charter, or are there things that can be done legislatively or rules or through a process that isn't the charter?
I know that Comptroller Behringer is working right now to streamline processes. That doesn't require an ordinance. It doesn't require a change to the charter. It requires a public official studying how her office does business, talking with folks in the know about how things can be done more efficiently, and then putting those processes in place. And that's a great example of fresh blood at City Hall getting things done.
Are the things you were talking about with the wet signatures and the needs for bid, is that ordinance, rule, what pot is that in?
Yeah, and that's something that can be done by ordinance. So when we talk in terms of processes and at least a certain number of bids and how those bids are called, how an agreement or a decision is made on which bid to accept, those are all things that can be controlled, that are controlled, frankly, by ordinance. And there is work going on right now to address that.
And that was going to be my next question, because I've had a ton of these conversations since the tornado hit with alders from the affected wards and not from the affected ward. And there's a general frustration with the red tape. Is there starting to become enough of a critical mass there where things could move?
The critical mass exists. And I can tell you that that within the halls of the board, the work is getting done. It is not now to the point of filing a board bill, but we are getting near. The work is getting done.
This is not a small lift. This would be changing large portions of the city law.
It needs to be done, but it needs to be done correctly. It needs to be done in a way that protects the fiduciary, the financial responsibilities of the city to its residents. So it's easy to say, hey, guys, get it done. But we are changing a system that has been in place for many years, and we need to make sure that when we put the new system in place, it's done responsibly.
Politically Speaking is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. Fifth Ward Alderman Matt Devoti, thank you so much for being on the show today. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Until next time, so long.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.